On today's episode of The Good Word, Tim Cato joins us to discuss the Dallas Mavericks, who are finally playing up to expectations, why the Western Conference is being dominated by young teams, and we try to figure out if the red-hot Milwaukee Bucks are for real. All that and a lot more coming up right now. Welcome to The Good Word. My name is Vincent Goodwill, senior NBA reporter for Yahoo Sports and the host of this show. Don't forget, wherever you get your podcast, you can listen to us here. But most importantly, we are on YouTube. Today, we are joined by my good friend, Tim Cato. We had him on before the NBA Finals last year because we did a lot of hanging out in Dallas, where Tim took me to some of his world-famous Dallas hangouts. And I live to tell about it. He used to cover the Mavericks for The Athletic. Now he's on the beat for DLLS. You can find his writing at alldlls.com. And of course, you can find his daily Dallas Mavericks podcast, the one that he hosts with Mark Stein, by searching DLLS, Dallas Mavericks podcast, wherever you are listening to this one. My man, Tim Cato, how you doing?
It's a little tricky to say. DLLS. You do have to start slow and then you can work your way up to DLLS.
But it's a lot.
You chose the right way to go about this. You gotta work your way up. So, but I'm doing good, man. How are you?
Hey, man, it is December 1st or 2nd, and I'm trying to figure out where the time went, but this is where we are. And now we're almost a little bit past the 20 game mark. I wanted to get you on to talk about Dallas because they've had, for it to be not even 20 games, it feels like they've been had like a tale of two seasons, right? Where you start November and you lose to Houston, Pacers, Suns, Denver, Golden State, Utah. And then you've won 8 out of your last 9, a few of those on the back end with Luka Doncic not being out because he's had wrist injuries and other ailments, but the wrist was the thing that put him out, including last night where you were without a load of guys. No Kyrie, no Klay, no Lively, no Najee Marshall, no Dante Exum. But now they sit right at that 4-5 line in the West. So how do you sort of encapsulate the season to date?
They've had a funny season. It started inconsistently. It's had a lot of inconsistency throughout it. It was, I would say the start of the season was fine. It was about what you would expect from a team that is integrating new parts and new pieces. And then there was that 4-game losing streak, and that's when things really got a little rocky. And every single game came down to the final possession. And it's one thing to lose to Golden State. It's one thing to lose to Phoenix, to Denver. But when you lose to the Utah Jazz, and Kyrie Irving didn't play that game, but losing to Utah, that was the moment where everybody really started just second guessing or questioning whether their expectations, it's the moment where I started questioning whether the expectations I had for this team were inflated or a little bit too high. And then that winning streak started. And yeah, 5-1 without Luka, and then Luka comes back. And they win without Luka. Obviously, the schedule's been a little bit easier, but I think it reset the expectations or put them back on the track that I was expecting. Yes, there's been some inconsistency, and certainly some reasons for it that we can dive into. But to me, this is a very good team. This is going to be, obviously just off a finals run, but this is a very good team that just took a second for the role players, for the Quentin Grimes and the Najee Marshalls coming off the bench. That's what I saw early in the year, that those guys were just not quite sure how to fit into the team, how all that was going to work. And then finally, honestly, in a weird way, Luka's absence really helped those guys enmesh themselves with the team. It was already starting to happen, and I by no means think it was because Luka Doncic was out. It's just that you remove one star, all of a sudden these guys get elevated. And, they become more comfortable with what they're being asked and what they're doing within the system. They're being asked to do a little bit too much now. And so it's good that Luka's on his way back. Kyrie missed the last game in Luka's debut or return. But, this team does need to be healthy. You can't ask Najee Marshall to be a, you know, 20-point scorer over a multi-week stretch or something like that. You know, there's been some stuff that has been good for the team in terms of the role players feeling adjusted and comfortable and clearly showing what they're able to do. But it's also not so sustainable that this team, you know, can just keep it going forever. So I finally think, I think the team is getting healthy. They typically have been somewhat slow starters under Jason Kidd, and they've really put it together on the back half of the season. And this was the year that it wasn't supposed to be that. This is the year they're supposed to have so much depth that they could get ahead in record and standings and not have to have some just fantastic February, March, April run to get back to where they want to be in the playoff picture. And yes, it didn't start exactly that way. Obviously, I think they're 7-8 at one point under 500, like 15 games into the season. But I do think it's starting to come together in the way that they, people like me, expected it to before the year. I think that's beginning to happen. And if it's happening now, and if the team can stay healthy and keep that going, it is starting a lot sooner than it has in past seasons, even if it was a little bit slow, you know, within just the first few weeks of the NBA season.
It's interesting, Tim, that you bring up the Luka absence, because that's kind of one of the places that I wanted to go here. In some dark, really dark corners of the Mavs multiverse, while he was out, there were some people saying, hey, maybe we should trade Luka. I think that's ridiculous. But I do think it's fair to ask the question, with what he does, the high usage, not staying in shape, having to work himself into shape, the injuries, the nagging injuries that usually you associate with older players are happening to him younger, is this style sustainable for multiple seasons and multiple runs through the NBA playoffs, where you get more wear and tear the longer you go along?
Yeah. One thing I'll say about the internet is that you can find everything there. I think any opinion of any sort. And I saw some stuff, you know, kind of directed in that line of thinking.
Yeah, that ain't happened. Let's be perfectly honest.
Right. Of course not. I think that Luka's already changing a little bit. His usage is a bit down. His time on the ball, his number of possessions, all of that stuff is a touchdown, not a lot down, and it shouldn't be a lot down. He was an MVP, you know, he was a top three MVP candidate last season, and Dallas went to the NBA Finals. Clearly, what Luka is doing at his best is not something that needs to be fixed. Now, possibly it needs to be tweaked a little bit. And one thing that I think Dallas really believed, and they went about doing it this offseason, is that he did have just too much offensive responsibility throughout the regular season. And that's why you bring in Najee Marshall, a ball handler. That's why you bring in Spencer Dinwiddie as the, you know, final guy that they added this summer, instead of somebody who isn't quite, you know, they were considering Dennis Smith Jr., considering Talen Horton Tucker. Spencer Dinwiddie is probably the most point guardy of those players. And they did this all with a purpose, that Luka should touch the ball a little bit less. He should, you know, be off the ball and then find his spots a little bit more. And that is going to take some time for him to adjust to. But I do think that's happening. And everything else that comes with him, yes, he's sometimes going to work his way back into shape. Yes, he says every single year he's going to stop complaining to the officials and does it for a little while and then kind of gets right back on it. But he's a, you know, again, top three MVP candidate. He hasn't been that this season. And I think if the murmurs and the frustrations with Luka have really, you know, where they have come from, it's come from the fact that he hasn't been his best when he's been on the court. And, you know, I think that we saw a better version of Luka in his return from injury. Obviously, it was one game, and it was a game against the Portland Trailblazers. So we'll see how things go. But I don't really have any doubts about him getting back to being the player that we're used to him being. I think it happens every year. And can it be frustrating that every year it has to happen? Sure. But, you know, you put up with that. Just like, you know, there are so many oddities and quirks and weird aspects of superstar players, of the most talented players alive, that franchises put up with. His might be, you know, a touch more frustrating and debilitating, you know, and impact him a little bit more on the court itself. but you know, this is not a new thing within sports. And you know, the main thing is that, you know, for Luka, it's not a question about his commitment to winning on the basketball court. It's a commitment that he knows he can get away with a little bit too much. But when it really comes down to it, you know, I think that this is a player getting back to where he needs. And I think he is adjusting. I think you are starting to see some adjustments led by the coaching staff, led by the front office and how they shape this roster. I think those changes are starting to happen slowly. And just like any habit, you know, any routine or thing that you've done consistently for, you know, what, Luka's been in the NBA a half decade, you know, more than a half decade now, it will take some time to override those expectations, those habits, those, you know, everything that people can complain about him. It's not going to be overnight. But the fact that we're starting to see it, I think, is a positive thing for him, for the team, and frankly, for his career going forward.
Look, I think you brought up like a point I want to nail down on. For a long time, it felt like, oh, best player on your team, high usage. Let's just run high usage into the ground, because the best decision that you're going to have is that guy making a decision. And when you have Nikola Jokic winning the championship, when you have LeBron James winning championships, that confirms that. But I feel like there is starting to be a little bit more of a turn. Maybe we won't see it bear complete fruit this year, but I don't know if Nikola Jokic having this type of career year at his age with all this responsibility is a good thing. We've seen the slowdown with LeBron James. You're seeing the toll, at least organizationally, that the Dallas Mavericks believe that this can take on a Luka Doncic. That's why you bring in, like you said, a Spencer Dinwiddie. That's what they went through. It felt like some wholesale roster changes around the fringes for a team that just went to the NBA Finals. I mean, that's one of the reasons I think you have Kyrie Irving, is he's a guy who, for one, I've made fun of Kyrie Irving a lot throughout the course of time for a lot of different reasons, many of which have nothing to do with basketball. But if we're talking basketball, Tim Cato, the man has been spectacular this year. He's been their most consistent player. He's seemingly, the one game that they lost, I want to say to Denver, where he scored like 16 in the fourth. The only reason they lost that game was because Luka hijacked the shot and it completely killed whatever momentum they had. And as opposed to Luka being looking around and saying, okay, Kyrie's got one going, let me be decoy, it just completely killed the rhythm that they had. But going back to Kyrie, he's been completely spectacular this year.
Yeah, and going briefly back to the point, which we'll build into in Kyrie and his importance, Luka's usage has been, so think of the best player in playoff series. Jason Tatum, Nikola Jokic, Stephen Curry, like the best player on the team that won the championship. Giannis before that. Yeah. Just to name off their usage rates in the regular season. So Tatum's was 30. Jokic was 26. Curry, again, this is the year that they won the championship, was 29. Giannis was 32. LeBron was 31 when he won. Kawhi was 30. And sometimes they would jump a little bit in the playoffs. But then you go Luka's usage, 36, 37, 37, 35, 36. So there's a stark difference between what these players on the teams that actually got the title, that actually won the title in the year, in those years, what their best player was doing and what Luka is doing. You know, every good player has a great usage rate, has a very high usage rate.
Absolutely.
They're always going to be top 10, top 20 in the league. Of course, that's what being a best player is all about. But Luka has been far outpacing that. And I do think that there is correlation that those stars won championships and that Luka consistently, you know, has been injured or certainly in the finals run, he was fading down the stretch. And I think a great person, a great player to show him a model of how he doesn't have to do that to that extent is Kyrie Irving. Kyrie Irving, as he has matured, is somebody who views a game in a way that, you know, you and I will probably never understand. He views it almost like poetically, where sometimes Mavericks fans can get frustrated when he's not exerting himself early in a game, but he finds moments to, you know, dip in and out of the flow of the game and realizes this is a moment that he needs to, you know, step to the occasion for. And sometimes he's a little bit more passive than you would expect, you know, of a player that good who can go get a three-pointer and really go get any shot he wants a lot of the time. But Kyrie understands that, you know, basketball is 48 minutes and that, you know, Kyrie is a 32-year-old who is, you know, pacing himself both in the regular season, throughout the regular season, for the postseason. And I think that's something that Luka is learning. And to Luka, you know, in Luka's defense, he has played with some dog-ass rosters. And sometimes there has been no choice. You know, the old front office before Nico Harrison, but even then, you know, in Nico Harrison's first year, this front office built teams that was built for Luka to be the usage king. Mm-hmm. You know, they built rosters where
this is only a car that he can drive. This is only a car that Luka can drive.
Sometimes the second best ball handler on a Mavericks roster was like Trey Burke. That's not a joke. You know, sometimes he had no choice of the matter. You know, right. Josh Richardson was a guy who came in. I'm blanking, you know, Harrison Barnes early on. So he has cycled through some players who, you know, just aren't going to be that number two. Even as Jalen Brunson emerged, he was behind them. You know, it was really that man, you know, that two-man show. It's not a surprise that, you know, the deepest playoff run that Luka made before, you know, before last year's finals run was to the conference finals and Spencer Dinwiddie was coming off the bench. Yep. And they all of a sudden had a you know, a three-headed ball handling attack. Luka was the best player. He's always going to command the most usage. But adapting to that is so critical. And so this, you initially asked me about Kyrie Irving, and I took a very long way to get to Kyrie Irving specifically. But he's been just sensational this season. He has been incredible. Everything is you know, his three-point shooting is, you know, it was over 50% up until very, very recently. When Luka was missing games, this was the guy driving the team to these wins. Everybody else around him was stepping up, but, you know, there was a game in Atlanta where all the role players kind of got Dallas to the fourth quarter, but then Kyrie realized this is the moment, and Kyrie Irving had not been shooting well in that game. And I think he went 6 of 8 in the fourth quarter. He took the second most shots he's taken in his entire Dallas career. And to me, that is kind of when you talk about like the ebbs and flows and the way that Kyrie, you know, goes in and out of a game in a positive way. You know, that was a moment where he had a horrific shooting percentage. And, you know, if he was a player who just, you know, was worried about his efficiency or, you know, worried more, you know, he could have just been like, okay, I don't have it tonight. And thus, we're not going to have it. You know, they're missing some other players the second night of the back-to-back. And then he goes in there and the shots go down and Dallas wins that game. It's been a very selfless on-court performance from Kyrie Irving. It's been a sensational on-court performance. And then you asked anybody about the team, and he's their locker room leader. He has been fantastic off the court, you know, leading these guys, but also pacing them. And that's that thing I think that we keep coming back to. That's the theme of this Mavericks season. Is that they have been to the finals and they lost. They were exhausted. They hadn't been there before, you know, outside of Kyrie Irving. They hadn't been there before. And nobody kind of knew what to do with themselves. And it really showed in that 5-game defeat. So this season for Dallas, you know, we'll see how much, you know, the talent is going to live up to it. You know, all of that, you know, the Western Conference is always getting more difficult. You know, it's no guarantee they're getting back there, but this is the way that they've built the season, the way they're approaching the season, unquestionably is with an intention that they're going to pace themselves. They're going to, you know, play not for 82 games, but play for 100 games. And now the most important players on the Mavericks, they kind of know what that feels like too.
Look, this is a team that does not fear going into someone else's building for Game 7 in the playoff series. So, and although you want home court advantage, you are not afraid of not having it. Now, onto the point for Luka when we were going back talking about usage. Last year, only Embiid had a higher usage. This year, Giannis, LaMelo, Zion all have higher usages than Luka this year. Giannis, luckily, has been healthy. LaMelo just got hurt. Zion always hurt. Embiid, enough said. So from a standpoint of just being able to conserve your body so that you're not producing so much wear and tear so early in the season that's going to have long-term effects beyond the season, I think Dallas is doing the right thing. And hopefully for someone like Luka, like I remember, before we go to break, I remember, Tim, you're like 15, so you don't remember this. But
younger than that emotionally.
Probably so. But the Lakers, when the Shaq and Kobe Lakers, it was a second year of that three-peat. So it was 2001. And Kobe had gotten hurt at some point throughout the regular season. And Kobe was trying to find his way. And he wasn't really happy being like underneath the top billing next to Shaquille O'Neal, right? Like Shaq, like Kobe was really trying to ascend himself to this spot. And he wound up getting hurt with maybe like 8 games or something like that left in the regular season. And the time away allowed him to see, oh man, okay, we really got something here. We can win another title. I'm not going to come in and disrupt this thing. Now, granted, Shaquille O'Neal is there and not, you know, Derek Lively, Daniel Gafford. No disrespect to them, but you understand the point. I do think that being able to sit down for a minute, rest your body, rest your mind a little bit, and watch how your team functions without you. I do think that that helps in some way. And you talked about the stacked Western Conference. We're going to talk a little bit more or a lot more about the depth in the Western Conference right here on the other side. We pay some bills with a good word. Back here on The Good Word with Tim Cato. Tim, I'm looking at the Western Conference standings. And I saw it yesterday when the NBA put out this goofy thing about this is the first time the first and second seeds in both conferences have played against each other since December 1st, 2012. I'm like, oh, that's really interesting, you know? And you're looking around and you're thinking, Kevin Durant is, you know, healthy and the Suns are really good when he plays, but not so much when he's not. Stephen Curry is playing on a really deep, perhaps too deep, Golden State team. LeBron James is playing with the new Wizard of Westwood and J.J. Redick, and the Lakers still barely beat the Utah Jazz the other night. You look at the West, and you're looking at the Thunder at the top spot, Houston in second, Memphis in third. I didn't say Dallas. I didn't say Minnesota. I didn't say Denver. It seems like youth is being served in the Western Conference.
I think I have a reason for it.
By all means.
It's the CBA, man. It really is the early effects of the CBA. And the CBA has always incentivized this to an extent. But there's such a big difference between having a max player who's making 25% of the cap or 30% of the cap, or having two max players making those lower percentages. Mm-hmm. Rather than these veterans who are making 35%, who are taking up so much money that, you know, one thing you said is Kevin Durant, he's been amazing. You know, if he had been healthy all season, he's in the top five MVP for me. But he hasn't been healthy, and there's not enough depth behind, you know, on that Phoenix Suns roster to back it up. And Phoenix is a very specific case,
right,
of course.
Right.
Their money is wild.
Right.
But I do think that you're starting to see that, you know, these teams that have these 35% veterans, you know, 35% of the cap, that's how much they're making. It's just harder to build a team behind them. The specific ramifications of this new CBA are only right now starting to take hold. You know, it's obviously, you know, in the Karl Anthony Towns trade was, mm-hmm. you know, the first huge, you know, like, you know, bang of the you know, gavel against the gong, you know, of, okay, yeah, things are going to be a little bit different.
Did you say bang of the gavel and the gong? I just wanted to make sure you get that right.
Yeah, a gavel banging a gong, you know? I don't know. Siren, a you know, red flashing lights, just something to kind of note, you know, some kind of indicator that, okay, things are a little bit different. But yes, I did say that. Not the smoothest wordplay there. But I think that's a lot of what's happening here is that the younger you are and the, you know, the more depth you can build out, the more talent you can add to your roster. And I think that's really benefiting these teams. Like Memphis, you know, Memphis is a team that isn't paying any of these, you know, maxes because there's tiers to max contracts.
Yes.
And it used to be that LeBron James on a max contract was the best. You know, was the best contract in the league. It was the best value you could get because at the same time, and again, no disrespect, but, you know, LeBron was making the same money at times as like DeMar DeRozan. And the difference between what LeBron James does for your basketball team and what DeMar DeRozan or, you know, insert any player. I mean, Cho Johnson back in the day.
Yeah, yeah. Insert max player here. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. The difference between that. But I think we're starting to see that on a team building level to an extent as well.
I think it's, you bring up the interesting point. A, that's a function of Chris Paul's CBA, right? Even though Chris Paul is no longer the head. And when you're the head of the CBA and you are approaching your 30s and you wind up putting mechanisms into the collective bargaining agreement that allows for players who are older to get more of a greater percentage of the salary cap than before when they were younger, more spry, more reliable, you're taking up a greater chunk of the cap and you're no longer the best player. You're no longer the guy that you were when you were taking up a smaller piece of the pie. I don't think Tim is saying, I don't think that I'm saying, I know I'm not saying, these guys should not get every single dollar, especially on the back end of their career. The salaries are going to go up. You're always going to leave the game presumably in a better place than when you picked it up. That's fine. But from a team building standpoint, if LeBron can no longer be 2019 LeBron, which you shouldn't expect him to be, he's about to be 40 years old, and Anthony Davis is still Anthony Davis, might be the best defensive player in the league next to Big Vic, and you're on a bad defensive team, that means you are getting a lot of veteran minimum type of players. You're taking chances and hoping that the Dalton connects and the Austin Reeves and those type of guys are working itself out, and the league is too good for that. When you look at a team like the Houston Rockets, you probably can say, most people would say, oh yeah, Jalen Green is there. And they may not even know that he's nowhere near their best player. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like you wouldn't think Alperen Şengün or Fred VanVleet or wait, that crazy dude Dylan Brooks is over there. Like there's a lot going on there. And of course, I think Oklahoma City is approaching household name level because we've seen them before. And we've seen kind of like this slower build over the past couple of years, even though they lost to Houston on the road in a really thrilling and exciting game. But we are approaching the level of seeing Oklahoma City is like, oh yeah, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, I know him. They got one of those Jalen Williams' guys. And then they got Hartenstein. And you're figuring out, oh, that's an Isaiah Hartenstein that does not look the way that I thought he looked. Unless you were a Knicks fan. So yeah, I think
Ty Jerome also falls in that category.
You know what? There was another name yesterday. Oh, it's the Bucks. The Bucks have a name that I was like, wait, that can't be who you are. Because I know someone by that name.
And well, we'll talk about AJ Green later.
There we go. We'll talk about AJ Green later. See, that's what Tim, see? We right here. This is not Two Americas after Thanksgiving. We are calling it dressing on this podcast here. Tim, not stuffing. See how that works?
Absolutely. You're so right, Unc.
Okay, we're going to pause this show right now. You will not call me Unc. Tim, I'm not even 10 years older than you.
You just said I was 15.
No, you said you were 15.
No, you said it first.
Okay, fine. Easy. I ain't Unc. I can be Mr. before I'm Unc. I ain't Shannon Sharp. I don't need all that. No, sir. Now back to the lecture at hand. I'm very curious. Like you talked about the CBA, and I want to drill down that for a second here. Cause I was talking to someone yesterday about like the changes that some of these teams have had to make, like teams like the Nuggets and teams like Minnesota. My fear is that you won't be able to sustain excellence year to year because of said CBA, and teams and ownership groups are making hard salary cap decisions to give them a little bit of flexibility, because if you hold on to the team you have and you wind up giving your guy that 30% max and you trade for a guy and you give up draft picks to get them, you're hamstringing yourself to not being able to improve. And I don't know if that's good for the game, Tim.
I think the market for max players is going to fall too. I think that the low-end max players who used to get the max because they were doing max production. Like the NBA, we all had this understanding of, oh, if you average, you know, 25-5 or 22-5-5, you're a max player. And I think teams are going to get stingier about that. And it doesn't matter that if you used to be a max player under that, you know, salary, if all of the NBA realizes we can't win by building this way. Now, the downside is that there still may be teams, you know, teams that, you know, who are not currently playoff teams who are willing to spend that money. But mm-hmm. I do think the market overall is going to go down. I mean, you know, I know we covered Dallas plenty, but it brings me back to even Kyrie Irving. And one of the reasons that Dallas was able to get Klay Thompson was that, you know, they obviously traded for Kyrie Irving, but even when they re-signed him beneath his max,
right.
You know? And so right now, Luka, who is not on the max, he's on the middle max, and Kyrie Irving, who could be making 35% of the salary cap, because there wasn't a market for him, you know, signed a bit under that. They're both making, I believe it's 43 for Luka and 41 for Kyrie. That's about half the salary cap. So that gives you room and navigation and you know, ability to go sign, you know, a player like, you know, like Klay Thompson and a player like Najee Marshall and a player like Quentin Grimes. And so I do think that, you know, I think it's more important than ever that you know, contending teams do not pay max money to players who are not contributing in a max way. If Bradley Beal, and again, Bradley Beal, he got that money from Washington and earned it. But if you were to assess the value in Phoenix, like if you were to cut Bradley Beal's salary in half, that's probably about the value that he's providing to Phoenix. And all of a sudden, Phoenix would have so much more flexibility to build a better team around this older group. Again, this is a combination of, like, you know, the players are going to, you know, adapt to this just as the teams are. That's what happens every time. There's reasons that the CBA got written in this way. But when I think about how young, you know, the young trends that are happening in mm-hmm. the Western Conference, that's just where my mind goes on all this stuff.
Yeah, it's funny because you think of Houston, you think of, oh man, they got all those young players. And Ime Udoka, who is a fantastic coach, aside from all the other Ime Udoka things that we talk about or we don't like to talk about in those rooms, you don't have a guy making that percentage. I think Fred VanVleet is making like $30 million, which shockingly...
He's making 42.
Is he?
But he's by far their highest paid player.
I don't know why I thought it was 30. Okay, maybe I got... I think I have
VanVleet's I just
number.
Pulled it up a second ago.
Okay, good.
So
thank you for that correction, stat boy, because Blog Boys would have been on my ass on that one. But no, there is something to... And the thing with Fred, that's not a loan contract. So they still have flexibility in the way of, oh, if this isn't working out, we can get from under this sort of thing.
And their best players, Şengün and, in my opinion, Amen Thompson, are both rookie scale still.
Oh, by far. And when you talk about the scale, and I want to stay at this point, you talked about teams being more fiscally responsible about giving out max contracts or whatever was perceived to be a max contract. The first and second best players are going to get those max deals. It's the guys who are the third best player on your team. Will a player be satisfied saying, I'm making $40 million a year, but it's not my max? Will a player be satisfied saying, I'm making 30? I'm making 30, because max means something more. I think because there is no, there's like a cap because there is a max salary. Players look at that. Okay, I'm a max player. I have to get a max salary. If you get less than that, even a dollar less, they feel taken. And I think it's going to have to be a shift in some philosophy one way or the other in terms of team building. Now, who's going to be the first player to take less? Who's going to be the first team to toe the line at their third best player and say, we're not doing this here with you? And what are those reverberations when it happens? I'm really fascinated by all of this, especially as these old dudes start to age out.
Yeah, and it's a fantastic point. You know, is over time, you're absolutely right. The max label means something to players, and it should. And I get it. I totally understand why it does. Will the increase in the money, you know, these preposterous, like, you know, you can be making $40 million a year and not make max. 10 years ago, you couldn't make $40 million a year, period.
Right.
Point blank in any scenario as an NBA player over a year.
Do you want me to tell you the first max? You want me? I'll give you a quick history lesson because I'm a geek. If I remember correctly, after the 98-99 lockout, that was the lockout spurned because Shaq had signed for 7-120, KG had signed for 6-120, and Mike had 1 year contracts where he was signed for 30 and then 33 and was still underpaid. So when the max salary was implemented after the 98 lockout, I want to say the first player who signed what was a max contract, believe it or not, it was either one of three players. It was either Kobe, Allen Iverson, or Ray Allen, part of that 96 draft class. And I want to say the number for that contract was somewhere around 6 years and $77 million. That's mid-level money now, y'all. Like, you wouldn't even get a mid-level dude signing for it. Granted, you're not getting six-year contracts, but getting an upwards of, what's that, $12 million a year, 12
like,
and change?
Like 12 or 13, yeah.
12 and change. Now, granted, that's 20 years ago. You got inflation, everything else. We're not going to have an economics lesson here, but y'all get what I'm saying. The money just means something different, but the name Max means all of it. And you know what's funny? Because John is in his infinite wisdom is going to send me a note. Well, Jalen Brunson signed for less than a Max and he doesn't care, which is true because Jalen Brunson is going to sign for the 10-year Max when he gets to the 10-year mark. It's a nice, cute, and cuddly story right now. Best believe. We can, if we still here in 3 years or anywhere else, I'm going to say told you so. When Jalen Brunson signs a 10-year max, assuming he's healthy, for the max. Don't get it twisted, y'all. Now, on the other side of the break, we got one more break for you. We're going to talk about the surging Milwaukee Bucks here on The Good Word. Time for today's last word here with Tim Cato. Tim, a team that I've talked a lot about here over the past couple of weeks or opening month of the NBA season, they were right there at the bottom with the Philadelphia 76ers, like dragging the ass of the Eastern Conference, and that was the Milwaukee Bucks. Now you look up, and they are above 500. They're 10-9. Now, granted, in the Western Conference, that will probably put them at the 13th spot. But let's just say, for sake of argument, they have climbed themselves back to respectability, right? When it won, like, I don't know, maybe 8 out of 9 or something. They've won some crazy amount. Maybe 6 out of 7, maybe 7 out of 8, somewhere around there. Top 10 in offensive rating, top 10 in defensive rating.
You were right.
Okay, 8 out of 9. There we go. Top 10 in offense, top 10 in defense in November. Remember that name I was telling y'all about that was a little different when I say his name? His name's A.J. Green. And when I think of A.J. Green, I'm thinking of a big black wide receiver. This A.J. Green ain't no wide receiver for the Milwaukee Bucks, but he is shooting the blood out of the ball. And he is filling that spot, Tim, where, man, we don't have a lot of athleticism. We don't have a lot of shooting on the wings next to Dame and Brooke Lopez and Giannis. They just needed one guy to hit, and it looks like between he and Andre Jackson Jr. that they're hitting on that.
Yeah, and as a white guy, I can say this. A.J. Green is a white-looking white guy. I'm a white-looking white guy, but like he is a white-looking white guy.
He is.
A.J. Green, yeah, I remember seeing him a little bit last season, and I was like, oh, this guy is shooting. Was it last season or was it preseason? I remember seeing him in preseason. You know, but yeah, he's been on, he's a 3 year. I'm just trying to remember when I remembered him. But yeah, he's been around Milwaukee a little bit. But this is obviously the biggest role he's had for the team. And that shooting really matters. It's definitely affecting, what you're seeing on the court. I won't pretend like I've seen a bunch of Milwaukee games recently. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to lean on you a little bit with this. But what I'll say is that Giannis is, him and Jokic are the best two players in the NBA. And I'm from Dallas saying that. And I legitimately believe that Giannis, he is still that guy, and this team is going to go where they go. I was not super high on Milwaukee coming into the season, and so I felt real vindicated the first few weeks of the season, and so right now I'm just pretending like it's all going to come crashing back down so I can be right, because that's the most important thing for an NBA journalist. It's to be right. It's not to adapt to what's actually happening. It's to be right. Damn it. But seriously, this is an impressive stretch. And what I have seen is that finally, at long last, that thing that we thought was going to happen from the jump, it's Damian Lillard and Giannis Antetokounmpo, that synergy is starting to look like it's there a little bit. Surprised it took this long, or, you know, disappointed, quite frankly, because I love watching those two guys. But it does seem like it's coming in a little bit, and so very curious to see where it goes from here.
Yeah, it's one of those interesting things, because we're looking at, man, why don't they just run pick and roll? And now you're starting to see the inverted pick and roll. Giannis is ball handler. Dame setting the screen. Dame flaring out, which honestly might be a much better solution than even Giannis going downhill, because Giannis going downhill works when Giannis already has the ball. I don't know if I need Giannis as the roller as much as I want Giannis going downhill.
He's not a roller. No, everybody always thinks like, okay, well, he's so tall and big that he could fit into any team. No, he is a ball handling wing on offense. That is his role. You got to put the ball in his hand. You got to put the ball in Giannis's hand. So I completely agree with you.
Yeah, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Like, if Giannis is ball handler, you can swing to the opposite side when you get middle, when you create that gravity with Giannis and Dame. If you swing to the opposite, the weak side of the floor, and there's Chris Middleton against a weaker defender, because you got to have your two best defenders on Giannis and Dame, cool. Now we have something. I think also because they're the Bucks, and because they did what they did with Adrian Griffin and Doc Rivers, everybody brought the jokes. Then Dame gets hurt, Chris Middleton gets hurt, Giannis gets hurt, they get knocked out of the playoffs in the first round last year. Add to the fact they've won a grand total of one playoff series since winning the NBA championship in 2021. That's going to bring the jokes. That's going to bring the doubt. But the fact, if they've turned it around before Chris Middleton comes back, and yes, I know Brooke Lopez is old. This is like Brooke Lopez version 4, right? I feel like the software update on Brooke Lopez, there's probably no more software updates on Brooke Lopez. But I do think that he is still useful in that defensive scheme if Giannis is the Tasmanian devil on both ends of the floor. The problem is you're asking Giannis to be that guy all the time without fail, no error, no margin for error. I don't think they have that. But I also don't know how great the Eastern Conference is or how great the Eastern Conference will be in May. Cleveland's doing really well. Orlando's coming. Will the experience of the Bucks in borderline desperation, Tim? Because if it don't happen this year, it ain't happening.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the Eastern Conference that, you know, holds me back from saying, oh, Milwaukee's back. Oh, Milwaukee's fixed everything. They're the team that they're supposed to be when they made the Dame trade. 8 of 9 is impressive. And, you know, Brooke Lopez, someone you mentioned, I mean, he's been so good during that stretch. 17 points on 55, 44, 75. You know, it's still, you know, not quite the defender he was, but, you know, very, very good.
Being big works. Like, being just big and wide.
It
like,
really does.
You're not going to see a whole lot of people dunking on Brooke Lopez. And then you're really not going to try to dunk on Bobby Portis. That probably won't work well for anybody.
Yeah, no, exactly. And, you know, like, you know, we're talking about Giannis and, yeah, put the ball in his hands. He's a wing. He's a shot creator. You know, since Luka Doncic came into the NBA, obviously, I look this stat up in the context of I write about the Mavericks. Luka Doncic has created the most threes for his teammates. The second player on that list is Giannis. So since the 18-19 season, the player who has passed to a three-point shot that has been taken by make or miss, the player who has done that the most times by raw numbers, it's Luka, then it's Giannis. And so, yeah, it does make sense that someone like AJ Green, even if he's named in a very curious way, it does make sense that he's getting more minutes. You know, they still got Pat Connaughton, you know, over there. They've got Brooke Lopez spotting up. And that's why it makes sense that, you know, if you want to run Dame popping away, you know, in an inverted pick and roll, that's why that makes sense to me. And so I hope things are clicking a little bit better. I'm still wary of it. I need to catch some games of theirs, and I need them to just keep doing this for
they got a
few
big
more
game
games
tomorrow here.
Because it's the Eastern Conference. And I just can't fully trust them until I get like a few more weeks of this. But yeah.
They got a big game in Detroit tomorrow. The NBA Cup game. The 3-0 Detroit Pistons against the 3-0 Milwaukee Bucks. Like, for whatever reason, whenever the courts get funny, the team in Detroit like, whoa, we're going to play. Now, I went to AJ Green's basketball reference page. You know, it has the nicknames for, you know, players. The nickname for AJ Green, Dairy Bird. I didn't come up with that myself. Man. Dairy Bird. Oh. And he's from Cedar Falls, Iowa. I've only been to Iowa one time in my life. And the story I'm going to tell, John will not allow to be in this podcast. So, John, you can play the music. So, yes, that is why AJ Green and Iowa and the Milwaukee Bucks. And not for nothing, as soon as you finished talking about AJ Green, you brought up Pat Connaughton. I just thought that was hilarious. But Tim, my man, really appreciate you, man. Did you like that story?
I like that story a lot.
I thought so.
I'm very sorry, dear listener, that the music played over it.
They will live. Maybe one day, John. I'm sure John, in one of his fits of rage or something like that, would just put that on YouTube somewhere and be like, I don't know who did it. It'll be fine. It'll be all right. But thanks to Tim Cato for giving us some of his time today. Thanks to producer John and the entire team who worked so hard behind the scenes on this show. If you haven't already, go subscribe to The Good Word with Goodwill on YouTube or wherever you get your podcast. Leave us a rating and review. I'll be back on Wednesday with another episode. Until then, everybody be safe.